Even now, a mere handful of survivors struggle to defeat the monsters that Nicol Bolas left behind to slaughter us. Bolas will not leave Ravnica as he found it. Bolas is never sated, Vivian repeated. There is literally nothing left of my world, Scala, thanks to him. The dragon must die. There were shouts of accord at this, followed by shouts of discord. It was all falling apart. Lavinia spoke up.
One thing is certain. If we fight among ourselves, we stand no chance against Bolas.
Aurelia shouted,
Hear, hear! The fate of Amonkhet and Scala must not befall Ravnica.
Gideon, who still seemed less than convinced, noticed Ajani studying him from the side. The Leonin held out his hand. Gideon took it and stepped down off the dais. Ajani said,
Remember your oath. The oath of the Gatewatch. Surrender is not the answer, my friend. The archer is right, and you know it. One such as Bolas will never be sated, nor will he show mercy. He views such things as weakness, and any attempt at such an appeal would only enhance his appetites.
Gideon took this in and nodded. Then he ventured into the crowd, moving among the planeswalkers and gilded alike. He spoke, and they listened.
Now that you all know of our existence, you could be forgiven for believing our ability to traverse worlds is an excuse for a planeswalker to always run from a fight. But we of the Gatewatch took an oath to always stay. It was a choice we had the luxury to make, and somehow we thought that choice made us superior. Now we stand among you with that choice taken from us. Now the choice is whether or not to fight.
He unsheathed his sword with intentional dramatic effect, raising it high into the air.
This is Blackblade. It has already slain one Elder Dragon, and it can destroy Bolas as well. With it, I hereby vow to take back this world. Who's with me?
His speech roused the crowd, which began to gather around him. Ajani put a hand on his shoulder, and that simple gesture acted as a trigger. From every side, planeswalkers and Ravnikans reached out their hands to touch Gideon, or, if farther back, to touch someone touching Gideon, as if to draw strength from the strength of his conviction. It was a galvanizing moment. Gideon felt Jace Beleren's touch within his mind. He had remained up on the dais and was smiling down at Gideon Jura.
I don't know how you do it, Jace thought to him, but I'm damn glad you do.
Just then, a small Izzet goblin entered from a balcony door, shouting,
Masters! One of them god eternals approaches at the head of a small army of those undead creepies! You got about 11.5 minutes before they's here!
Gideon chuckled.
11.5 minutes. One had to admire Izzet precision.
Jace called out,
6 challenges! 6 missions! We need volunteers! Now!
33. Kaya. Finding a workaround for recruiting the Azoria Senate and its collaborating guildmaster, Dovin Bon, was assigned to other volunteers. But as guildmaster of the Orzhov Syndicate, Kaya was tasked with bringing the other 4 wayward guilds, the Golgari Swarm, the Cult of Rakdos, the Gruul Clans, and the Selesnya Conclave, to the table for Ral Zarek's Operation Desperation. It was thought that, as an outsider, she'd bring less baggage and suspicion to the endeavor than Zarek himself, but that as a guildmaster, she'd still bring enough prestige to be granted the necessary audiences. Her first stop would be Selesnya, which she hoped would be the easiest of the 4. Kaya had 3 companions, Teo and Rat, both of whom had somehow become her entourage, and the nearly silent elf, Nyssa Rivain, whom Jace hoped would get on well with Emara Tandris, the elven leader and acting guildmaster of Selesnya. Unfortunately, getting to Tandris was proving difficult. To begin with, they had to avoid the Dread Horde being led by the god Eternal Ronus, which was just minutes shy of overrunning a packed Senate House and taking out all of Bolas's significant opposition in one fell swoop. Fortunately, Rat was able to lead them down passages, alleyways, and shortcuts that the invaders from Amonkhet couldn't know. Rivain seemed impressed enough with the speed of their progress to actually say a few words.
"You know the city well,"
she said to Rat while avoiding all eye contact with the girl in her somewhat distracted way. As they approached Selesnya territories, they did run into a single and unavoidable crop of Eternals searching for victims. Teo put up a shield, and from behind it, Rivain asked permission of an old birch tree, which promptly grew multiple branches that spiked through the brains of each and every Lazatep skull before retracting. The attack was so swift that 2 or 3 seconds passed before the Eternals began dropping to the ground, well and truly dead. They found the conclave well and truly fortified, and unwelcoming. A long line of Ledev guardians and Sagittar archers blocked their path. No one would let them pass, even on their diplomatic mission. Rivain, in particular, seemed to be public enemy number one for having awakened Vitu Gazi, resulting in the elemental's departure, dismemberment, and near-complete destruction. The victories that Vitu Gazi had won before encountering the god Eternals, not to mention the cheers of the Selesnians until that moment, were well and truly forgotten. Kaya began to think she'd have to ghost her way in to get an audience with Imara when Teo called out, "Where's Arathia?" Nyssa asked,
"Who?"
Impatiently rolling her eyes, Kaya was about to explain to the elf that Arathia was Rat, when suddenly Rat's voice called out,
"Over here!"
Teo and Kaya turned to find Rat approaching from behind the Ledev line, riding on the back of a centaur. Kaya was frankly stunned. She'd known centaurs on her home plane, and if you even looked like you wanted to ride one, you were as good as dead.
"Oh well, maybe the centaurs of Ravnica are more accommodating."
Ledev guardians parted, bowing to allow the centaur to pass. Rat said,
"Mistress Kaya, Teo Varada, and Miss Rivain, allow me to introduce you to my godfather, Spearmaster Boruvo."
The centaur bowed his head to Kaya and Teo in turn, but seemed to make a point of not bowing to the elf, who watched the proceedings in silence, looking extremely uncomfortable the whole time. Rat continued in her mile-a-minute manner.
"Boruvo was Gruul Clan once before joining Selesnya. He's a good friend of my parents, and they made him my godfather. I mean, he was the obvious choice, the only practical choice when you think about it. I think my father's always been a little jealous of my relationship with Boruvo. Not that that's why Boruvo left the clan. He had a calling, you see. He thinks I have one too, and really wants me to leave the Gruul and join Selesnya. And sometimes that does feel like the right path for me, but I guess I'm pretty indecisive when it comes to..."
The centaur cleared his throat and said, "Goddaughter?"
"I'm rambling again, aren't I?"
"It's understandable, but I believe we have business to attend to."
He turned to Kaya and Teo, saying,
"Anyone with the good taste to take notice of our Arathia deserves a chance to be heard."
Again, Rivain leaned in to whisper,
"Who is this Arathia?"
And again, Kaya was going to tell her that Arathia was Rat. But Rat grinned and shook her head, and Kaya turned to study Nyssa. She was looking directly at Rat and yet looking right through her, as if Rat weren't there. It suddenly occurred to Kaya that Rat was invisible to Nyssa. She thought back to Rao's reaction, or non-reaction to Rat, and the way everyone had combined Teo and Rat's names when Teo had introduced them both. Was Rat invisible to everyone except Teo, Boruvo, and Kaya? Invisible, perhaps, even to her own father?
Rat said, "It's not invisibility exactly. I'll explain later."
Invisible? And maybe just a little psychic?
Had the girl read Kaya's thoughts, or just read into her expressions? Kaya had felt no touch upon her mind as she had earlier that day with Balerion. Then again, Beleren had been shouting loud commands to a few dozen people simultaneously. Maybe he could be equally as undetectable when he wanted. Kaya knew Jace created illusions, too, rendering himself invisible to the naked eye or the naked brain.
Is that what Rat's doing?
Send the elf away,
Beruvo said, immediately commanding Kaya's full attention. He was glaring at Ravaine with intense contempt.
Send her away and I will escort the rest of you to speak with Emara Tandris.
Kaya was about to protest. After all, Nyssa Ravaine was supposed to be their secret weapon to win Tandris's favor. But Ravaine was already backing away, looking somewhat relieved. She said,
I've never been very good at talking. You two go with the centaur. I'll join Gideon.
34. Gideon Jura. Gideon flew Promise into battle alongside Aurelia and her Sky Knights, while Angrath led a ground force of 30 or 40 planeswalkers and three times as many warriors of Simic, Izzet, and Boros. Whatley, who seemed to have a history with the Minotaur, had warned against Angrath's self-interest and rashness.
Hey, you don't have to worry about me,
he huffed with some internal bitterness.
All I want is to defeat the damn dragon so I can get back to my daughters. Honestly, I don't know why I ever leave him in the first damn place. I always think I'll just take a little break and planeswalk away for a couple days, and then I wind up on some damn plane with that damn immortal son and get stuck there for years at a time. Well, I'll be damned if I'm going to let that dragon cost me more years away from my family. So put me to work. You won't be sorry.
Gideon thought him sincere, and even Whatley seemed convinced, and she was certainly prepared to admit Angrath would be a dangerous foe to the Eternals.
Damn straight, he had said. I can take out five at a time with my chain, I wager.
Still, when Gideon looked down, he saw Whatley at Angrath's side, at least in part to keep an eye on him. They had all gone out to intercept the god Eternal Ronus. The Serpent God was closing in on the Senate House with multiple phalanxes of Eternals marching in his long shadow, while Eternal Avon, Drakes, and Angels circled his head like flies. Or they circled until the Sky Knights approached. Then they sheered away from their god to attack. Fortunately, the air battle was right in Aurelia's wheelhouse. Gideon was the only planeswalker in the sky, and he was protected by his aura of invulnerability. So there was no need for any special defenses. It was straight-up aerial warfare, and frankly, the Eternals, though dangerous, were simply outmatched. It was a different story on the ground, as Gideon noted, while swooping this way and that atop Promise and slicing off Lazatep-coated heads with Black Blade at high speeds. Below him, he could see that with few exceptions, the planeswalkers were reluctant to get too close to the Eternals, instead using their magics to destroy the enemy from a distance. This was understandable, but not always effective, and was certain to cause even more resentment among the Gilded. Among those exceptions was Angrath himself. The Minotaur ignited his heavy iron chain with his pyromantic power, and sure enough, as he swung it round in wide arcs, he'd destroy four or five Eternals with every rotation. He had waded deep into the crops. Too deep, to be honest, given that all an Eternal had to do was get a good solid grip on him. The length of his chain tended to keep them at bay, but on occasion its impact with a Lazatep shell would disrupt his swing, leaving him extremely vulnerable. That's when Whatley would step in, or rather, step out from within the arc of his chain to have the Minotaur's back. She might not like Angrath much, but she wasn't going to let him die. Inspired by the pair, a few of the planeswalkers began to engage the enemy directly, and not without success, but also not without danger. A danger once again made obvious when a Vedalken planeswalker was grabbed by two Eternals and harvested before everyone else's eyes. One of the two Eternals combusted as the Vedalken's spark shot up into the sky, arcing toward the plaza and Bolas. The second Eternal also combusted, thanks to a vengeful Angrath, who whipped his chain around the creature and pulled it taut, while Whatley once again backed the Minotaur, driving her blade into the heart of yet another Eternal, who was attempting to ensnare Angrath from behind. Clearly, the Vedalken's fate had a chilling effect on the rest of the planeswalkers, who again pulled back en masse to settle for ranged attacks. And even that didn't necessarily work. Ronas reached out faster than Angrath's chain, grabbing a human planeswalker with a shaved head and metal-casting powers. She attempted, in the few seconds she had left, to summon her flying shrapnel to attack the God Eternal's tail to free herself, but it was all too little, too late. The shrapnel did no discernible damage to an Eternal of Ronas's size, and within seconds, her spark had been harvested. Gideon hoped that if nothing else, the serpent would combust as the other Eternals did when delivering their stolen sparks up to Bolas. But no such luck. The God Eternal had the power to harvest, deliver, and still survive. He moved on, crushing two Simic Biomancers without even trying. Understandably, this put an even bigger chill on the efforts of the other planeswalkers, and it wasn't doing much for the Guild Warriors either. Fear was setting in. But Gideon had no such delicate constitution. Ronas had turned his attention to the aerial combat and was quickly becoming a significant problem. The flying Eternals, bereft of soul, passion, and real independent thought, might be overmatched by Aurelia's well-trained, passionate, and free-thinking Sky Knights, but the Serpent God was not. He swatted them from the sky left and right. Gideon decided it was time, once and for all, to learn just how potent a weapon Blackblade actually was. "Come on, girl," he whispered to Promise, and she responded instantly. With only a slight touch on her reins, he was able to direct her between two Eternal Drakes, one of which he sliced open to its spine in passing, toward the God Eternal's left side. Ronas had just backslapped a Boros rock and its rider out of the sky, and as the god's hand swung around, completing the arc of its swing, it briefly flattened out, palm up. That was all Gideon needed. He leapt off his Pegasus and right onto Ronas's outstretched hand. The God Eternal turned his head. Despite the Lazotep plating covering his snaky features and the decided lack of anything resembling a true sense of self, the serpent actually looked surprised, but only for a moment. He closed his fist around Gideon, and purple light emanated from between his Lazotep plates as he attempted to harvest Gideon's spark. But Gideon's aura shone white around him. He remained invulnerable, untouchable. Ronas could make no direct contact with Gideon's skin, or even his garb. Of course, being squeezed, virtually crushed by a giant cobra, wasn't exactly a picnic. But Gideon's hieromancy largely protected him from that, too. Once again, Ronas's face expressed an actual, if brief, emotion. This time, confusion. Why did this planeswalker not die? The serpent god lifted Gideon up to study him at eye level. And once again, that was all the opening Gideon Jura needed. He reached back with his sword and stabbed it forward with all his might, piercing the cobra god's eye. Blackblade, the soul drinker, drained into itself whatever remained of Ronas's essence. Gideon could actually feel the weapon getting heavier. Maybe not physically heavier, but morally, magically, psychically heavier, without a doubt. Ronas was quickly reduced to a husk not unlike those of the planeswalkers he had harvested. And just as quickly, that husk began to crumble to dust. Gideon's footing on Ronas's hand disintegrated beneath him, and he began to fall. He was easily 100 feet up. Aura or no aura, this was going to hurt. Or it would have. Promise swooped in and caught her rider across her back. The saddle horn drove into Gideon's ribs. His invulnerability protected him.
It still hurt.
But
it was worth it. A cheer erupted from all sides. That's one down, Gideon thought, and it was a thought shared by a smiling Aurelia, by Angrath, Quatley, and every other non-eternal combatant in range. Inspired, they all pressed forward. The Eternals, at least these Eternals, were now clearly doomed. Gideon pulled himself upright onto Promise's back, and from that lofty perch, looked toward the plaza. He couldn't help it. His thoughts turned to Liliana. He knew Jace's squad was going after her. A part of him wanted to fly over there to stop them, to save her. A part of him still believed she was salvageable. But another part of him couldn't defend her anymore. Liliana Vess had crossed too many lines. 35. Liliana Vess. Though she was too far away to see the specifics, Liliana could feel Ronas cease. Her connection with the Serpent God had moved in and out of the forefront of her consciousness as other Eternals intermittently required more immediate attention. His destruction came as a relief. One less god to control, one less burden to carry. That many fewer victims weighing on what passes for my conscience. She couldn't be 100% sure, but she'd wager heavily on good old Beef Slab being the cause of the God Eternal's demise, which came as something of a relief as well. Gideon's invulnerability, in essence, made him immune to the Elder spell. After every other planeswalker fell, Gideon Jura would still be there with Blackblade attempting to kill Bolas. Liliana wouldn't be able to help, of course. Her contract with the dragon made that impossible. But that didn't mean she couldn't root for Gideon. After all, she sure wasn't rooting for Nicol Bolas. In fact, she was doing her best, within the bounds of her contract, to thwart the dragon as much as possible, to mitigate the damage he was doing to life and limb. She gave Bolas's Eternals very little agency and even less assistance. She was doing everything in her power to prevent them from entering any buildings, from following their prey indoors. Frankly, if more Ravnikans had simply had brains enough to stay off the streets, there might have been a lot less carnage this day. Now, with the Elder spell giving the Eternals a view of every planeswalker's spark, it had become more difficult, but still, she tried her best to curtail their actions without drawing the dragon's attention. I mean, given my circumstances, what more can they expect from me? So, of course, she wanted Gideon to win. And if Gideon does win? Well, I know I've crossed a line today. A few lines. More than a few. But she'd always been able to explain those lines away to Beef Slab, to manipulate him into seeing things her way. She could still save herself. Of course I can. 36. Teo Virata. It wasn't like he'd never seen greenery before. He had, of course. Gobakan wasn't a complete desert. Oasis had a small park in the town square, and there was a garden at the monastery, too. But once again, Teo Virata was made to feel as if he'd come from a very small world onto a plane of wonders. He had never seen such a quantity and variety of shades of green before in his life. And inside, no less. Vines that reached up 100 feet, 200 feet, scaling marble walls and balconies. Bushes, shrubs. Honestly, he didn't even have the vocabulary to describe what he was seeing that spilled out across the tiled floors. Trees growing indoors. That is, if you could call this indoors. Every space was open to the air. It'd be useless, even dangerous, as a shelter during a diamond storm, or during an eternal attack, for that matter, but so far, neither had reached these halls. And the scents, the rich aromas and perfumes of all this green, and all the flowers, and all the Selesnya of the place, were intoxicating.
Rat was still riding on Baruvo's back as he led Teo and Kaya for their audience with Amara Tandris, the Selesnya Conclave's acting guildmaster. The corridors of almost glowing marble were lined with archers and soldiers, all wearing armor decorated to look like leaves or like blades of grass. Many were elves. All lowered their heads in slight bows to acknowledge Baruvo. All of them eyed Teo and Kaya with the slightest hint of a threat. None of them seemed to even glance at Rat. They passed through an arch guarded by two immense creatures holding axes. Each had large tusks, bigger than a boar's, and each had a snout that stretched way beyond its face. As usual, Teo had never seen anything like them. They too nodded to Baruvo, glared at Teo and Kaya, and took no notice of Rat. Light was just beginning to dawn on Teo when Kaya spotted the look on his face and leaned over to whisper, "Only the centaur, you and I, can see Rat. Somehow she's invisible to everyone else, even her father." "It makes no sense, and yet it explains everything." Teo must have been staring at Rat, because she grinned back at him and gracefully slipped off the centaur's back to slip in between her new friends and attempt to clarify. "I'm not invisible," she said. "I'm insignificant. A rat. A little rat. You see one, you look away. You try to pretend you didn't notice it. You try to forget about it until you do forget about it. Your mind rejects its presence." "You're not insignificant," Kaya protested. "You're sweet to say so, Mistress Kaya, but I am." "It's magic," Teo said. "I suppose," Rat replied with a shrug. She was still smiling, though Teo thought her grin had faded into something bittersweet. "Magic I was born with. Not many people can see me unless they know I'm there and concentrate. My father's good at that, but he has to know I'm around to manage it. Before today, there were only 3 people who consistently have been able to notice me on their own. My mother, Baruvo, and Hekara." Kaya nodded. "That's why you were so upset when I told you Hekara was dead." Rat shook her head emphatically. "No. Well, maybe that was part of it. But mostly I was upset because Hekara was wicked cool and wonderful. But yeah, I guess it hurts to know there's one less person who'll take notice. Of course, then I found the two of you." Teo and Kaya each took one of Rat's hands and gave her reassuring squeezes. At which point, they all turned a corner and came face to face with what could only be Amara Tandris. She was a tall elf with pointed ears, pale eyes, and hair the color of corn silk. Or maybe just the color of light. She wore a long white dress with a long white robe or cloak or maybe cape draped over her shoulders. She stood before what Teo at first thought was a tree. No, not a tree. A woman. Or 3 women. Or 1 woman with 3 torsos and 3 heads. Or 1 3-torsoed, 3-headed woman who was also a tree with hair made of autumn leaves. The center head torso woman seemed to be asleep. The other two faced away from each other. The one on the left was crying hot tears. The one on the right crossed her arms angrily. Teo had given up trying to understand this strange world. Girls who could not be seen by their own fathers, women who merged with trees and each other and yet could not get along. Teo decided there and then that all he could do was try to be of some use. Baruvo bowed low, which was an interesting sight to behold in a centaur. He said,
"Milady Tandris, you know Guildmaster Kaya of the Orzhov Syndicate. With her are her associate Teo Varada and my goddaughter, Arathia Shokta, still gateless."
Teo tried not to smile when the centaur called him an associate. He wondered briefly how Abbot Berez would have responded to his new title. Amara Tandris was squinting, scanning the room. She said,
"Arathia is here?"
Rat waved, the sad smile replaced by the old rat grin.
"Here, m'lady."
Tandris blinked twice and said,
"One more time, please. I'm here, right between Teo and Mistress Kaya."
Baruvo offered some help, too.
"She's between the other two, m'lady."
Ah, yes, Imara said, suddenly beaming with pleasure.
Teo swallowed hard.
Have I ever seen such a smile?
The elf said,
Oh, child, I wish this wasn't so difficult. It's such a joy to see your face and hear your voice. Only because each time is like the first. Trust me, milady, if you saw me every day, you'd grow quite tired of both. I sincerely doubt that.
Rat shrugged, still grinning.
I could prove it with 5 minutes of conversation, milady, but that's not why we're here.
Tandris sighed heavily, grew serious, and turned her eyes on Kaya.
I know why you are here.
Imara, please, Kaya said. We need to unite the guilds. Ral has a plan passed down by Niv to save Ravnica, but it won't work without all 10 guilds cooperating.
And it may not work even if all 10 guilds cooperate. Correct?
Kaya didn't respond, but her silence spoke volumes.
Guildmaster Kaya, we both know Ral Zarek and Niv-Mizzet loved their plans, their strategies, their blueprints. So far, everyone has been an unmitigated disaster for the guilds, for Ravnica, and especially for Selesnya.
But this time, the Izzet always have names for their projects. Nothing is real to them unless they name it, define it, give it limits. Which is why we have so little in common.
What is Ral calling this one?
Kaya hesitated, looking almost embarrassed. But then she straightened her back and said in a clear voice, Operation Desperation. Imara Tandris almost chuckled. She certainly smiled as she shook her head, the way a mother would shake her head at the antics of a child. Kaya was ready for that.
I know what it sounds like, but desperate times do call for desperate measures. The planeswalkers and the guilds must unite to defeat Bolas.
I don't disagree, Kaya.
Well then?
Tandris interrupted her again. It was strange. She had a way of interrupting that didn't seem rude. She seemed to glide in, her voice growing up between Kaya's words, the way blades of grass grew up between paving stones. She said,
I'm sorry, but there's little support for anything resembling unification within Selesnya. Things were bad enough before the loss of Vitu Ghazi. But now...
She trailed off. Teo turned to see how Kaya would respond and noticed that Rat was no longer standing between them. He quickly glanced about and saw the girl whispering something to Baruvo, who was leaning down for just that purpose. Teo thought the centaur would literally bend over backward for Rat. Teo then realized that he would too. Baruvo cleared his throat and said,
Milady, it was Bolas's creatures that devastated Vitu Ghazi.
Yes, Kaya said, exactly. And this wouldn't be the first world where Bolas has wreaked havoc. Two planeswalkers, Vivian Reed from Skala and Samut from Amonkhet, report that both their worlds were absolutely devastated by Bolas. Skala is completely dead, and Amonkhet's few survivors are struggling to, well, survive, while Bolas's monsters continue to ravage what's left of their home. In fact, I suspect the troubles on my world may be Bolas's handiwork as well. Make no mistake, Imara. The dragon is turning all of Ravnica, if not the entire multiverse, into a grave.
Suddenly, the center tree, head, torso woman woke, crying or keening or maybe just humming. Teo found he could not quite identify the sound. The other two turned toward her. As did Imara Tandris with a gasp and Baruvo with a low bow. Teo must have looked as confused as he felt, because Rat was again at his side, quietly offering up an explanation.
She is the Dryad Trostani, the true guildmaster of Selesnya, the voices of its Perrin. You know, its founder, Mat Selesnya? Mistress Sim in the middle is the Dryad of Harmony. She has been asleep and unresponsive for months. Now she's awake.
Yeah, Teo said. I got that last bit.
The Dryad on the left is Mistress Oba, the Dryad of Life. On the right is Mistress Sez, the Dryad of Order. Without Mistress Sim, they have been at odds, split, and unable to reach a decision for the guild. Milady Tandris has been trying to keep Selesnya together during Tristani's, absence?
The keening of Mistress Sim got louder, peaked, and fell away. Everyone waited with bated breath. Finally, she spoke, or rather sang, or, oh well, Teo wasn't quite sure what she was doing. Though Mistress Sim's mouth moved, her words were like music in his mind, like a breeze across the sands, or through trees, he imagined. It was much, much gentler than the telepathy of Jace Beleren, and yet, as with Jace, Teo felt the words more than he heard them.
I have heard the song that plays in the wind, sisters.
The Dryad of Harmony turned to the Dryad of Order.
Says, Bolas's order is the order of the grave. You have fought with your sister, but she is still your sister. Is it truly your wish to see her ended? To see all life ended?
With that encouragement, Mistress Oba appealed to Mistress Sez as well.
There is a great order to life. Is that not enough?
Mistress Sez was silent for a time. She looked away from her sisters. She looked up at the sky. Frankly, her expression reminded Teo of nothing more than that of the abbot after one of his most pathetic acolyte's many failings. Then, with a nod, Mistress Sez acquiesced, saying, singing,
Trastani is once again in harmony. It is the will of Matselesnia that the conclave join the other guilds to defeat Nicol Bolas.
37. Raoul Zarek. Mizium turbines churned as the small, almost skyship ferried Guildmaster Raoul Zarek and Chamberlain Mari toward Beacon Tower, deep in Azorius territory. Last time Zarek had ridden aboard Golbet Frezel's cloud lifter, it had been raining, and the wind had blown cold and wet through the open-air gondola, chilling him to the bone. This time, the sky was grimmer still, dark with the Elder Spell, lightened only by the harvested sparks arcing through the air toward Bolas atop his citadel. Zarek and Mari watched from above through telescopes of various magnitudes as one, two, three more planeswalkers arrived on Ravnica, and as two of those three were almost immediately harvested by Eternals. A fourth planeswalker, a tall elf with a long white hooded cloak, was scooped up by the god Eternal Kefnet, who didn't even have the decency to burn for his crime as he sent the elf's spark to the dragon. Zarek felt grateful that Cloudlifter's ascending screw engines blotted out any sound of screaming. But it hardly mattered. Through his telescope's highest magnitude lens, Zarek could see every detail as the faces of the perishing planeswalkers tightened in rictuses of fear, allowing his mind to conjure every sound of horror he was missing, and reminding him of his own culpability in the slaughter. The beacon had brought these planeswalkers here to their doom. It had been Niv-Mizzet's brainchild, but Zarek had designed the cursed thing and even supervised its construction from a distance. Amid all his failures, including his ruinous attempt to unite the 10 guilds, this had been his one success. He'd been quite proud of it, of course. He'd fought to turn it on. He'd killed to turn it on. Such are the successes of Raoul Zarek, he thought bitterly. Minutes later, Cloudlifter moored alongside the top floor of Beacon Tower. Raoul and Mari found it lightly guarded by Azorius and Izzet soldiers. The Izzet quickly made way for their new guildmaster. Raoul had thought he might have to fight the Azorius troops, but no. Perhaps they were unaware that their new guildmaster, Dovin Bahn, was secretly working for the dragon, and thus would disapprove of Raoul's intentions at the tower. Or perhaps they let Zarek pass because they were very aware of Bahn's betrayal of Ravnica. Either way,
They provided no opposition. No, guards aren't the problem. The problem is my own damn thoroughness.
Chief Chemister Varivort, an Izzet goblin and the beacon's primary engineer, rushed forward to greet his guild's two top officials.
Master Zarek, Chamberlain Mari, so good of you to visit while all hell is breaking loose.
Meaning, Rao thought, why aren't you out there doing something useful instead of bothering me? He said,
We've come to shut the beacon down.
Varivort balked.
Creating the beacon was the last command of the Firemind.
I know that, Chief Chemister. But now it's being used to serve Bolas's ends. Bolas, who killed the Firemind.
Yes, all right, I see that. But there's nothing we can do. I can't shut it down. You can't shut it down. Per your own orders, Master, the device was designed with no way to shut it down in order to prevent Bolas from shutting it down.
I know that too. But I also know that any chemister worth his salt would still install some kind of backdoor failsafe.
Varivort shrugged.
The beacon still requires power.
No power, no beacon. That's the best solution I can offer you.
Mari rolled her eyes.
If only we knew someone with an endless appetite for power.
Rao knew she was talking about him, but thought her words also applied to herself, not to mention half the sentients on Ravnica.
Still, at least I know what I have to do.
He turned on his accumulator, placed his hands on the beacon's metal control panel, and began to suck in raw electricity through his fingers. It was fortunate that he had neglected to recharge the accumulator since before he had made his failed attempt to find Tomic. It was unfortunate that the beacon contained a tremendous surplus of raw power. Rao drained and drained and drained power from the beacon, but he could sense he was barely scratching the surface. He knew that very soon he would have to release some of this energy or his accumulator would blow, taking off the roof of the tower and killing everyone inside it, all without damaging the built-to-withstand-an-elder-dragon beacon. Varivort started to lean away, a hand shielding his eyes, shouting,
Master! Master!
Over the whine of Rao's accumulator. Mari watched sternly, but a corner of her mouth twitched once. The Azorius soldiers were backing away. The Izzet smirked at them, then exchanged nervous looks. Rao glanced back over his shoulder and saw that Golbet was piloting Cloudlifter out of range. Nevertheless, Rao kept at it, trying to drain the beacon dry. He was making progress, but the accumulator emitted a higher and higher pitched whine. Then it started sparking excess power.
It's no good. I've got to release, or we'll all be fried to a crisp.
He broke contact with the control panel and stumbled toward a balcony, desperately scanning the horizon for a safe angle of release. Spotting Kefnet in the middle distance, Rao unleashed a massive lightning bolt that sheared off Kefnet's right arm. The Ibis god didn't seem to notice. Rao stumbled back to the beacon's controls, out of breath and sweating. Mari, with an actual, if perhaps temporary and situational look of concern for him, attempted to steady him. But the static discharge crackling around him sent her flying back 2 feet. She landed on her ass, largely unharmed, but glaring. Rao ignored her. Again, he placed his hands on the control panel. He instantly felt he had made some progress. Not much, but some. Enough to test and prove the theory that the method had merit.
I can do this.
He continued to drain the beacon's power source.
This could take some time, but the end result is inevitable. The beacon will be silenced. No more unwitting planeswalkers called to Ravnica like lambs for the slaughter. It won't stop Bolas, but it will set a limitation on his power source, limiting the number of sparks he can devour. And that, at least, is something.
38. Teo Virada.
Something's changed, Teo said.
Yes, said Kaya. I feel it too. Ral must have succeeded in shutting down the beacon.
Planeswalkers can still come?
Rat asked. Yes, but they won't be drawn here. There's no summons to answer anymore.
And that's a good thing?
I think so. We're enough to defeat the dragon. Or enough to die trying, at any rate.
Rat punched Kaya on the shoulder, saying,
Well, aren't you a ray of sunshine?
Ow!
Rat scurried ahead, calling out,
This way!
Kaya shushed her.
Rat rolled her eyes.
No one else hears me. No one else wants to. Besides, we've almost reached Skarg. Now when we get there, you guys should let me do the talking.
I thought they can't hear you, Teo said, and then regretted it immediately, afraid he might have hurt Rat's feelings.
But apparently she was largely immune to that hard truth.
Most can't, but my mother, Arishakta, can, and my father can, if he's paying attention. Same with Borborygmos. He thinks I'm adorable, which I am. I'm an adorable rat.
She laughed, and the laughter echoed off the curving walls of the tunnel, tinkling back on the trio like a kind of music. Teo thought that the music of Imara Tandris and Tristani had been otherworldly and magnificent. But he believed he preferred the music of Aretha Shakta's laughter over any he'd ever heard in his life.
Her eyes are the color of solstice plums, he thought.
Then he blushed. They were moving through sewer tunnels like, well, like rats. It was dark and humid and close. Teo, raised in arid climes, was dripping with sweat. He worried Kaya and Rat would think he was sweating because he was afraid.
I am afraid.
But he didn't need or want them to know that. They were both so fearless, while he still struggled merely to be somewhat useful. Still, for all the horror and confusion, there was something liberating about being on Ravnica.
They don't know me. They don't know what a failure I am.
Their ignorance had gone a long way toward keeping him in the game. The abbot knew Teo Virata couldn't raise a decent shield to save his life.
These good people had no idea, and so Teo had been able to fool them, on occasion save them, and thus save himself.
They came to the end of a long brick tunnel. The stench was starting to get to Teo. Rat approached an iron door and knelt before it to quickly pick the lock. Quick enough to impress Kaya, who said, You are good at that. Better than I am, and I'm something of an expert. Rat rolled her eyes again.
Please, I learned to do that when I was 6. When no one knows you exist, they don't unlock anything for you.
She swung the door open, and instantly the trio could hear angry voices and the sound of weapons clashing. Rat scurried ahead up yet another tunnel, and Teo and Kaya struggled to keep up. The tunnel soon opened up onto an immense underground chamber, the cratered remains of a huge palace. Immediately, multiple axes flew toward Teo and Kaya's heads. Instinctively, Teo raised a 3-pointer, and an axe ricocheted off it. Kaya went incorporeal, and an axe sailed right through her, sticking a good 2 inches deep into the wall behind her. Both planeswalkers readied themselves for the next assault, only to realize they weren't being attacked. They were simply standing between 2 gruel opponents, Rat's father, Gan Shakta, and a massive cyclops.
That's Borborygmos, Kaya said. That's who we've come to see.
Their sudden appearance caused both combatants to pause their conflict. They had been fighting before a giant bonfire that only made Teo sweat all the more. And they weren't alone. 30 or 40 others, Gruul clan warriors, Teo assumed, had gathered to watch the battle. They now glared at Teo and Kaya, grasping and re-grasping their weapons with clear, hostile intent. Teo looked around for Rat, but didn't see her.
Can she make herself invisible to me as well? Or has she abandoned us?
Neither seemed likely. Borborygmos squinted with his one eye at Kaya. He began grunting elaborately.
What's he saying?
Teo asked in a nervous whisper while wishing he didn't sound quite so nervous.
I can't understand him,
Kaya whispered back, not a little nervous herself.
But I'm sure he recognizes me from Rao's earlier attempt to unite the guilds. Agreeing to attend that gathering cost him his supremacy among the clans.
The Cyclops raised a 4-foot-long mace and, grunting, slammed the handle into his free hand for emphasis. What exactly he was emphasizing was less than clear. Gan Shakta grumbled out a translation.
Borborygmos is half inclined to kill you right here and now, ghost assassin. He holds you and the Storm Mage responsible for his fall.
I understand, Kaya said carefully, and then pointedly, on the other hand, Teo and I helped save your life. And besides, we're friends of your... Before Kaya could mention Rat, an angry Gan Shakta barked out,
I need no reminders of my momentary failing. I owe you. I acknowledge that. But don't think for a moment I'm any happier to see you than the Cyclops. Believe me, you couldn't have come at a worse time.
We don't want to be here any more than you want us here. But there's no choice, Gan Shakta. There's no choice, Borborygmos. We need the gruel to...
A female voice interrupted, calling out with a mixture of elation and urgency.
She's here, Gan!
Gan Shakta turned.
Here? Where?
A woman stepped forward with her arms around Rat. The woman was considerably taller and considerably more muscular. She was also armed to the teeth, with a sword and an axe, 2 long daggers, and an iron chain wrapped around her waist like a belt. Nevertheless, she had the same dark hair and almost the same smile. The resemblance was obvious. Without a doubt, this was Rat's mother, Are Shakta. She responded to her husband, saying,
Right here!
All eyes around the bonfire turned toward the big woman. Gan Shakta squinted. He said,
Call out, girl!
I'm here, father, Rat said.
She's here in my arms, Gan,
his wife said. Then Gan Shakta smiled.
I see her.
Borborygmos grunted his own acknowledgement. A few others in the crowd nodded too, though Teo thought most were just pretending to see the girl to impress their betters. With a surprisingly formal air, Rat addressed her father and the Cyclops.
Great Borborygmos, legendary Gan Shakta, you must unite the clans and help the other guilds, or it will be the end of us all.
Gan Shakta growled his response, pointing at Borborygmos.
That's what I've been telling him, but the stubborn fool won't listen.
Borborygmos lurched toward Rat and held out his huge hand. She slipped out of her mother's arms and into his grip, which closed around her, practically eclipsing her. Involuntarily, Teo took a protective step forward, but Kaya put a hand on his shoulder and whispered,
She knows what she's doing.
The Cyclops lifted Rat up. She whispered something in his ear. He shook his head violently. She cupped her hands and whispered something else. Then she kissed his cheek.
By the storm, Teo thought. Did that monster just blush?
39. Dak Faden. Dak flinched as 2 of his compatriots knelt to flank him on either side. The first, the silver golem Karn, was intimidating enough. The second, the demon Obnixilus, was flat-out terrifying, an effect Nixilus seemed to enjoy, if not glory in, producing in Dak. The demon chuckled under his breath and said in a low whisper,
Are you prepared, Flea? That bridge was only designed to transport inorganic matter from plane to plane. The Eternals get away with it thanks to their Lazotep coating, but all you've got to pull you through is your fragile spark. I think you'll most likely burn up the moment you pass the portal's threshold. You seem like a betting flea. Care to wager on your survival?
Oh, leave him alone, Karn grumbled.
What?
Nixilus said, taking mock offense. He patted Dak none too gently on the back with a clawed hand that felt a bit like it was made of hot lava.
I'm doing no harm to the flea. I could swat him, after all. And what difference would it make to the multiverse? One less flea. One less flea who, when you think about it, is hardly likely to survive the day.
Dak glanced over at Karn, who didn't take the bait. Obnixilus actually yawned then and said,
But I won't swat our little flea. I've grown quite fond of him in the last 3 minutes.
Pat, pat, pat.
His palpable fear smells so delicious. And I can always swat him later, chew him up and swallow him if he begins to annoy. He wouldn't make much of a meal, but if I get peckish during the mission...
Ob let the semi-implicit, semi-explicit threat hang. Dak swallowed hard and sucked it up.
I can get through this.
They had a clear task to accomplish. Sneak through the planar bridge and shut it down from the other side on some plane called Amonkhet that Dak had never visited before. Fortunately, his third and final compatriot, an extremely intense human warrior named Samut, was a native of that world. She was at the opposite end of the roof, ready and waiting to take a running start. Frankly, having three scarily dangerous partners in crime should have been reassuring. Dak had, after all, volunteered for this assignment with more than a vague notion of self-interest. The only way off Ravnica and away from the spark-harvesting Eternals was through that portal, so through it he would go. He'd been assured his spark would indeed protect him during the crossing. That his assurance was belabored with a probably from Beleren and a most likely from Saheeli Rai had perhaps undercut its credibility, but survival on the streets of Ravnica among Bolas's planeswalker hunters seemed no more certain and considerably less appealing after the horrifying death of Raid. On the other hand, whether Dak would return post-mission to continue the fight was a different matter entirely. After all, if he helped close the portal, thus preventing more Eternals from infesting Ravnica, he'd have done more than his part for his adopted world. He did, after all, feel some responsibility toward Ravnica. He had a handful of friends here. Merrick and Leona were decent people, and Dak had grown quite fond of Leona's daughter, Kella. Not every Ravnican was another Jadash. But if he pulled off this little caper, he felt just fine with leaving the rest of the work to the real hero types. Dak was a thief. He was nobody's gods-be-damned hero. Crouching on a nearby rooftop, the planar bridge quartet had gotten as close to the portal as they dared without attracting attention. Now, the demon slapped a wing against Dak's shoulder and said,
You're up, flea.
Dak concentrated. Touching an eternal mind, let alone multiple eternal minds, was more disconcerting than anything he'd ever tried before. Their thought processes were so remote, so, well, deadened, it made the hairs on his arms stand on end. But the spell was simple enough. He focused on a crop of Eternals 30 yards in front of the portal, making them all think they were surrounded by planeswalkers with harvestable sparks. Inevitably, they attacked one another, swinging their weapons, grabbing hold, and attempting to ingest. It was soon a melee. And the more Eternals that emerged from the portal, the greater the melee. Karn signaled Samut, who zipped past them at an incredible speed. She literally ran straight down the side of the building and waded into the crowd. Karn leapt down, shaking the ground as he landed. Obnixilus stood. Dak didn't like the demon, but felt obligated to say,
Remember, you can't even let them get a grip on you or you'll lose your spark.
Nixilus growled,
I'll never allow anyone or anything to take my spark again.
Again? Dak thought. You can lose your spark more than once? I bet Raid wishes he knew that.
Obnixilus grabbed Dak under his arms, spread his wings, and flew them both toward the portal.
Gods be damned, it feels like my armpits are on fire.
Ob chuckled again.
Enjoying the ride, flea? Last one you're likely to take.
Dak tried to ignore him. He looked down. Below them, most of the Eternals were fighting one another. Karn and Samut were making short work of the few that attempted to get in their way as they cleared a ground path for themselves to the bridge.